The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. CNN, by the way, is just a side note. They're bragging because they've obtained a 2019 audio of Rudy Giuliani, they say, pressuring Ukrainian officials to announce a Biden probe in exchange for improved relations. This is related to Biden's son there. The thing that strikes me as odd is now that we know that the media wouldn't really roll with it anyway, right? Because there was the crackdown, the planned and orchestrated crackdown on any Biden related news and scandal news. What is it? I mean, I don't know what he thought he was going to accomplish there. Because anyway, we'll find out about that later. CNN's got all kinds of action going, and they've got their most credible Cuomo news anchor on it now. No doubt he'll ask his brother how things are going. But right now it's time to get to the big lead.
The big lead, big local.
You know, Seattle has a drug problem. I know that comes as a shock to you, and it's now the greater Seattle metropolitan area because everybody has a drug problem. And to cure it, the council, some counselors in Seattle want to legalize mushrooms, psychedelics. Shrooms, so to speak.
And we've also been in close contact with the advocates organizing around the Decrim Nature movement to reassess public policy in a progressive direction around entheogens, also known as psychedelics, and the city policy related to entheogens, following the lead of a number of jurisdictions around the country who have either made it a low law enforcement priority or even legalized or decriminalized the substances.
Now, that is Councilmember Andrew Lewis, who is far too young to sound that boring. He's got Sir Humphrey Appleby, the character on the great British comedy series Yes, Minister and Yes, Prime Minister, is a civil servant on the show who speaks unnecessarily complicated manner so that he can impress other people or obfuscate what he's actually doing. And that's what he reminds me there. It's basically, hey, what we want to do is we want to legalize some shrooms here. And he does have an ally in Shama Sawant.
Data has shown just absolutely overwhelmingly that the criminal justice system is a terrible response. We know Reagan's and the neoliberal era failed war on drugs did nothing but expand mass incarceration, decimating especially communities of color and working class communities. The criminalization of psychedelic drugs is only a small part of that mass incarceration problem, but it is a part. But more specifically, there is now significant research showing that these psychedelic drugs are very harmful, are rarely harmful, and can have very significant benefits. Research has shown that they can have a powerful benefit in some circumstances to treat PTSD, depression, and addiction.
All right, let's set aside some of the other stuff. You know, for example, while you might have a problem with the prison sentencing under the war on drugs was called upon because minority communities were being decimated by drugs, not by the policy against drugs, but by drugs. And that was a huge problem. It doesn't mean other problems don't come with solutions. That happens all the time, unintended consequences and so forth. But let's get to what she's talking about there, which is, hey, you know what? There's this, and I actually saw a story about this in a science journal I was reading, and there was a story about how hallucinogenics showed some promise in medicine. Well, that might be true. In fact, another counselor, whose name now escapes me, said that they were inspired by their friend who had an undiagnosed brain trauma, and they thought that the shrooms, the psychedelics, would really help because it was showing that a doctor had told them that there was some promise in psychedelics to help in these treatments of the brain. In these circumstances, you know, one, you should, if it's undiagnosed, you should get it diagnosed, you know, if you got a brain injury. But two, if you have a doctor saying that in certain medical conditions it can be treated, and doctors are showing some promise in treating certain conditions with psychedelics, that's a vastly different circumstance than somebody who's picked up using shrooms on the street, right? You know, I mean, if there's people that are tripping out in the middle of downtown, that's different from somebody who's dealing with a brain trauma and is getting a prescription at home. Right? You know, and look, you know, I tend to look at a lot of different crime and feel like our focus should be on greater restitution and less on spending $30,000 to $50,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. You know, I'd rather just put them to work with an ankle bracelet where they have to show back up at their apartment. And if they don't have an apartment, we could supply one for them and make them work, you know, clean up the streets, give them a broom and just keep them going. And then when they earn a wage of some kind, they have to give half of it or something to the person that they harmed. And if there's no direct individual harm, they can give it to the rest. They can pay it into the taxpayers fund or something. But, you know, and then save the rest so they can get a job afterward. But it's, you know, that's a different story. Seattle has this major drug problem. And for some reason, Seattle officials seem to think the real problem is them. It's the system. You know, that's where the real problem comes in, instead of it being a different kind of problem. There's, you know, it's like when people describe a homelessness. I hate using that term, like the homeless encampment, you know, at the public school in North Seattle. You know, it's really a drug encampment, right? Because you could walk in there and say, look, everybody, I'm going to take one person here and I'm going to give them a home tomorrow. And they could give that person a home, and I would bet a lot of money that the person that has that home would lose it very quickly because they've got deeper problems. But we ignore those problems, and we call one of the symptoms, as though, you know, we define it as though the symptom there is the problem, the symptom of homelessness. You know, drug addiction is a horrible and wretched thing. People do all kinds of things that they would never do otherwise, you know, and it makes good people become bad people and do horrifying and awful things, and to themselves and to other people, because the addiction is so powerful, you know. And you, again, you can give them a home, but they're not going to be able to use it. And that's a big, big problem. Federal Way, speaking of big problems, the Federal Way Council, when I read this story in the Federal Way Mirror, I had to read it three times because I didn't trust my own eyes, you know. And I did just get my new Costco reader glasses here, and I had to look at the date of the story, because when I read the story, I thought, this cannot be a story from June of 2021. It's got to be something earlier. Producer Nicole is high on shrooms, and she's given me the wrong story here. This is an old story she wants me to say is new. But each time, sure enough, it is a June 2021 story. Federal Way City Council has passed a hazard pay ordinance requiring local grocery store employees to be paid a $3 an hour hazard pay raise. At this point, when we're close to 70% of Washington residents are vaccinated, everybody at the store is either vaccinated or didn't want to be vaccinated at this point, or has had COVID. So theoretically, you know, they're good to go too. Nature's vaccination. And then you've got government stepping in and saying, just in the nick of time, I want to mandate a hazard pay for a business that I don't operate. You know, that's just insane. And then they say, well, look, this is going to be mandated for Walmart, Safeway, Winco, Fred Meyer, and then smaller grocers too, but we want them to pay for it through grant money through the American Rescue Plan. That's not a rescue plan. That's a handout plan, right? I mean, this is, it's like, you know, I know early on we had these posters from time to time. You'd see it like, you know, at the, you know, my grocery store clerk is a hero for being at work at all. And I just thought, okay, everybody works, everybody does this stuff, calm down. You know, let's not cheapen the word hero here. And yet now we want to make this mandate and have people pay hazard pay for a job that is massively less hazardous than it was 6 months ago. You know, by any interpretation, it's ridiculous. And it feeds into a fear factor on the public. And you know what it is. Part of it, it's got to be, hey, look, we've got some grant money available. We haven't used this grant money. Let's suck it up. You know, it's like, you know, little piglets running off to the mama and, you know, doing some suckling on the government dime, so to speak. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It's embarrassing. You know, I know some people might say, oh, look, well, at least I get an extra $3 hazard pay. And, you know, that's great. I totally get it. If you're working for the grocery store and somebody mandates higher pay for you, that can seem great. but it's a bad precedent. And, you know, it's another thing to try to inculcate a fear factor for people. Because if you're telling people they need a hazard pay, you think something's hazardous there. You know, and again, why is the government a federal way telling grocers how to do their business? You know, if there's if they need to pay extra, they can do that. You know, right now, the more important thing is getting people back to work who are not going back to work despite available jobs. So I feel sorry for Federal Way. This council is embarrassing. They should be embarrassed. You know, and I don't know what else to say about it. I'm so disgusted by it. It's like, you know, what happens when we have a real emergency and money runs out? If you have a rescue plan, America's rescue fund, and there's a bunch of money that we didn't need to spend, you know, let's not spend that. Let's just put it back to the Treasury so that our children and children's children and children's children's children won't have to pay it. How about that? And speaking of absurd things, there's a big push underway to get this from Channel 4 News. Big push underway to get Governor Jay Inslee to extend the ban on evictions. And, you know, we've talked about this ban before. Matthew Lang tells Channel 4 that he just couldn't pay the rent anymore.
In August, I fell off a financial cliff, paying about $3,000 a month in rent, which is something that I was able to take care of pre-pandemic. But when I was only making $200 a week on unemployment, that wasn't a thing.
Okay. One, $3,000 a week? Where are you living? I mean,
well, and rent, you're throwing away your money, man.
Right.
Buy a house.
Why isn't he buying a house somewhere? Where is he living? $3,000 a month? And he's like, well, I can handle that. Well, that's great for you. But no one, and his unemployment's $200 a week. You know, that's a pretty frightening drop of pay.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced frightening drops of pay.
Also, everyone was getting $600 a week. So that might.
That's also what I was wondering about there. It's like, this is a guy who's so good with money that he's getting at least $600 a week, but he counts it as $200 a
week. Right.
Were there did he owe somebody else money? Are they garnishing that wage? What's going on here?
I don't know.
You know, so he can't pay the $3,000 a month. I can't pay $3,000 a month. I don't own a house. You know, I mean, I don't want my mortgage to go to $3,000 a month. I mean, geez.
Well, again, you're kind of throwing away your money there. If you're putting that into some equity, you might return, and then you could get yourself out of a situation such as the one you were in.
I'd much rather have a $3,000 a month mortgage than $3,000 a month rent here, especially in this area. But anyway, you know, he can't pay it anymore. And by the way, the first thing I think of is then you should move. I mean, $3,000 a month rent, my first thought would be, all right, I got to cut expenses right now, and I'm going to figure out a place. Where's my closest friend, and does he have a room for that?
Well, I was going to say might be hard if you don't have a job to get another place.
Exactly.
But
well, I can get that. But I bet you, by the way, if you're paying $3,000 a month rent and you talk to your landlord and say, look, you know what, but right now I'm toast here and I would move somewhere else, but I just can't afford to get a different job. They might say, you know what? I've got just the place for you. You know, it's a $900 a month studio, just in this town a few miles over. Anyway, this is ridiculous. So Morris Groberman, Northwest Commercial Real Estate, says
we have a number of tenants that are not paying rent right now, and we're struggling as well.
Morris Groberman operates 80 apartment buildings. He says he has anywhere from 20 to 50 tenants who are not paying rent. He says the majority of them are working again.
It's frustrating. You know, if people aren't paying for groceries from the grocery store, it'd be frustrating for the grocer too. But, you know, we've done our part as housing providers, and it's time for the government to do their part and for people to do theirs and get back to work.
It's ridiculous. He's done more than his part. It's private property. They own the property. If you love this idea so much, then we should pay for it. Okay. Instead of running around trying to create hazard pay conditions for people that are not in a hazard job anymore, we should be paying people that are providing the housing that we have decided, I guess, that other people don't have to pay for. You know, you can't just take other people's property and say, you know, if you have two cars at home and we find out that some homeless dude in Seattle needs a car to get to work, they can't just come along and grab your car and say, you know what, for the good of society, we're taking your car without paying you for it. Right. We're supposed to pay. This is ridiculous. I don't know what sophistry we're using to try to justify this, but it's absurd. And by the way, there's plenty of people that I know people who have been very careful with their money. They've invested. They've bought up to, I know some who had up to 17 houses you know, and they just bought one after the other, and they're very careful. And over many years, they thought, this is my retirement and my legacy for my family. Then suddenly you've got people saying, oh, we don't have to pay forever. You know, and there's a lot of people out there that have a strong ethic that says, you know, I can't, you know, I have to pay. But I'll tell you this, there's, you know, the American Constitution is built on checks and balances for a reason. And that's because human nature is such that anyone can be corrupted, right? It's just a self-interest thing. It's a danger. We recognize it within each other that there is a danger of being corrupted, you know, by power. And if you have the power not to pay, and all of a sudden you can think, you know what I could do this month? There's an awesome water park at that Texas University that my nephew's paying too much money for. I could go sit in the lazy river, you know, whatever. I mean, why not? Why not go on that Hawaiian vacation instead of pay rent? You know, if the government's telling you don't have to pay rent anymore. So, you know, I mean, at some point, you got to force people to pay.
We're looking at maybe 250 to 300,000 households that could potentially face eviction or foreclosure on their home as a result of not being able to pay.
All right. That's Kendall Gregory with the Cancel the Rent Coalition. You know, so again, every single renter, every single landlord I've talked to has been wanting to work with people to try and get this stuff satisfied. It would be nice if people paid a portion of their rent. But, you know, if there's a lot of these owners, it's not like it's some faceless company out there. Even faceless companies, people's retirement's invested in that. You know, they have to pay the mortgage. That's why they charge rent, you know, or they have to pay on that investment. That's what people do. So, you know, you can work things out. You can try to pay a portion of it to try and keep your debt down. People in a crisis tend, especially a government mandated crisis, tend to be more understanding. But, you know, this has reached a level of absurdity. This is like the federal way thing at this point, you know, to say, all right, there's no plan to get this stuff back going again. Isn't there, like, at the very least, shouldn't there be a phased in plan now that says, all right, if you're not paying 50% of your rent, you know, by, you know, 3 weeks from now, you're going to have to start thinking about moving out, right? I mean, somebody's got to get some dough. How many stimulus checks have we had, you know, to kind of save up some dough and put up some, get in a room with somebody else? I mean, you can't just not pay for other people's property. And again, if we value it that much as a government, then we need to pay other people for that property, rent for it. Preferably not $3,000 a month for that guy. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Well, you heard it. Federal government says, hey, we're at 70% vaccinated. But the state government, which promised under Governor I Have All the Emergency Power, Jay Inslee, the same Inslee was super concerned about the amassing of power by President Trump, who, just a note for the non-Trump, for the folks that really hate Trump and the folks that like Trump or whatever, you don't amass power by deregulation, right? A lot of Trump's focus was on federal deregulation, like stripping away regulations means the opposite of amassing federal power. So Inslee, on the other hand, has been amassing his power. And then the state legislature had, you know, at least the majority party, Democrats, a majority in both houses, had every opportunity and every expectation, I thought, to maintain their own institutional authority and assert themselves as a better check and balance for an extended emergency. They opted not to. They said, no. Just all power in the executive. We prefer just the hands-on kind of guy. And I think that there's been kind of a, you know, people dislike Trump so much here that then they decided since Inslee hates Trump, that means everything Inslee does is great and wonderful and proper. So now Inslee says, hey, I'm trying to open us up as fast as we can. And if we reach 70% early, we'll just open up right away. So the federal government comes along and says, we've reached 70%. And then they say, wait a second, while they're using, you know, the previous census data, we're using, you know, some up-to-date, better up-to-date estimates. And by the way, they're counting 18 and over. We're going 16, you know, which all of this stuff is just Bolshevik. You know, it just shows if you've got businesses that have been struggling to make ends meet, retirements that depend on it, and you could open things up now instead of 30 days from now, you just do it. You let people start living their lives again. Because I'll tell you what, if we're up to 65 or 63, and some of the difference is going to be the age group between, you know, 16 and 18. And then we also have, who knows how we, at the very least, we've got 63-65% that are vaccinated, at the very least. And then how many people had COVID here? They're producing antibodies. So, you know, we've reached a point of absurdity to pretend and to keep ourselves from opening. And it's unnecessary pain inflicted on people. The state's doing fine, by the way. Our state government is awash in money and resources. We keep making more. So the state doesn't have the problem, but individuals do. And that's where the real problem comes in. Now, speaking of problems, at Yale, there was a special lecture. Now, this lecture is accredited. It fulfills licensure requirements set forth by the state of Connecticut. Target audience, trainees in child psychiatry, psychology, and social work, faculty, clinicians, and scientists. The title of the lecture is The Psychopathic Problem of the White Mind by Dr. Aruna Kilayani. Now, what does Dr. Kilayani, the appropriate it's appropriate, I guess, that she's got "kill" in her name. What does she fantasize about?
I have fantasies of unloading a revolver into the head of any white person that got in my way, daring their body, and wiping my bloody hands as I walked away relatively guiltless. With a bounce on my step, like I did the world a favor.
All right, so she's a lecturer with Yale that has one of the worst microphones for a Zoom conference that I'm sure she's well compensated for. It's just amazing. If you couldn't understand what she's saying there, she's talking about, she says, quote, "I had fantasies of unloading a revolver into the head of any white person that got in my way, burying their body and wiping my bloody hands as I walked away, relatively guiltless with a bounce in my step, like I did the world a bleeping favor." That's what she said. And that wasn't all. She's convinced white people cannot be fixed.
We're asking a demented, violent predator who thinks that they're a saint or a superhero to accept responsibility. It ain't gonna happen. They have five holes in their brain. It's like banging your head against a brick wall, just like sort of not a good idea. We need to remember that directly talking about race to white people is useless because we're at the wrong level of conversation. Addressing racism is things that white people can see and process what we are talking about. They can't. That's why they sound demented. They don't even know they have a mask on. White people think it's their actual face. We need to get to know the mask. Black rage has nothing to do with black people and everything to do with white people.
So, you know, if you're angry, it's all white fault, white demonic behavior. She says, quote, "We need to remember that directly talking about race to white people is useless because they are at the wrong level of conversation. Addressing racism assumes that white people can see and process what we are talking about. They can't. That's why they sound demented. They don't even know they have the mask on. White people think it's their actual face. We need to know the mask." I'm just repeating what she said in case you can't hear the distorted, really poor microphone. And at this point, again, this is Yale. Again, this is a speech that is accredited for trainees in child psychiatry, psychology, social work, faculty, clinicians, and scientists. The title alone of this, The Psychopathic Problem of the White Mind, you know, as though there's a white mind and a black mind and a Southeast Asian mind. I hate using just the Asian mind because Asia encompasses such a vast territory. I find the way we commonly use it to be a bit racist, you know, because you're assuming everybody from India is the same as everybody from China, is the same as everybody from Japan, same as everybody from Cambodia. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We need some better terms. But anyway, the psychopathic problem of the white mind, you know, imagine just switching that out. I mean, I know it's no big deal. You can insult the whitey McWhite guy all the time, but this just borders, I mean, doesn't border on the deranged. This is like jumping off in the deep end of derangement. And yet, it's a Yale lecture. You know, is there no standard at the Yale School of Medicine, Department of Child Study Center? You know, and when people are going to get their license and they have to attend a certain number of lectures, this is one of them? so they get to learn about how evil all the white people are. And I guess they're born that way. So watch out, white kids. I mean, this is just horrible in every way. Aside from fantasizing about killing white people, we make her blood boil.
This is the cost of talking to white people at all. The cost of your own life as they suck you dry. There are no good apples out there. White people make my blood boil.
Okay. So, you know, I say we because I did the Ancestry.com, and while I had like one shred East Asian. And then I guess they did a correction. I don't know how that works. They did a correction on DNA and that wiped that out and cut about in half my Irish component too, which was really upsetting. But she says that white people are just horrible in every way. Can't be redeemed. She's got the fantasies of killing them, doing us a favor. White people are out of their minds, and they have been for a long time. We're in a psychological predicament, she says, because white people feel that we are bullying them when we bring up race. They feel that we should be thanking them for all they have done for us. They are confused, and so are we. We keep forgetting that directly talking about race is a waste of our breath. We're asking a demented, violent predator who thinks that they're a saint or a superhero to accept responsibility. It ain't going to happen. They have five holes in their brain. It's like banging your head against a brick wall. And, you know, she did an interview where she said she'd rather hang out with Ann Coulter than liberals because she feels like Ann Coulter is in touch with her hate. You know, again, she's got a very stereotypical view of conservatives, but she feels like progressives out there, you're haters, you're just unaware of it, and that makes you worse. And she's just sickened by the whole thing. How did she go from academia to psychiatry? Her master's is in the humanities, and the focus is on critical theory. There's a shocker for you. She says she's not a neutral when she practices her psychotherapy. She's the same here in this room as she is anywhere else. She says, do you think it's your mission or your job or your duty to get to the root of a white person's racism or deal with their whiteness? No. That makes it seem like it's for me. If I were to do that, it would be selfish as bleep. Do I focus on ways I think race is seeped into everything? Yes, but it's not for me. I can actually see how white people are suffering in a way that's very unique and different from people of color. She points out that she believes white people suffer internally. She says people of color suffer from being positioned in the world psychologically and the stuff that goes with it, violence, this and that. Now, white people suffer from problems of their own mind. They suffer with trust. They suffer with intimacy. They suffer with closeness, shame, guilt, anxiety. They suffer with their minds. Don't get me wrong. People of color are also neurotic and have their own ups and downs. But there's a fundamental issue, I think, that's very unique to white suffering, and I think that's their own mind. It's colonialism. That's the cause. It's history. You can't. So she basically thinks that, you know, colonialism restructured the white mind. And this is somebody lecturing at Yale. Okay. This explains a lot about Bill Maher's assessment of college, most college expenses being a joke. We'll play some of that in awesome audio coming up. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. It's time for our awesome audio.
This is Dory Monson's awesome audio. Clips of the day.
Our Vice President Kamala Harris is in Guatemala, and she says being on the ground there is extremely important.
The reason I am here in Guatemala as my first trip as Vice President of the United States is because this is one of our highest priorities, and I came here to be here on the ground to speak with the leader of this nation around what we can do in a way that is significant, is tangible, and has real results. And I will continue to be focused on that kind of work as opposed to grand gestures.
Yeah, sick of those grand gestures. Speaking of grand gestures, after about a year and a half of everybody in Zoom meetings, doesn't it seem odd when somebody says, I had to take a special fact-finding mission down there so we could speak face-to-face. And no reporter says, you know, I thought Zoom was good enough. Can we do Zoom? Would that work for everybody? It was working for everybody for about a year and a half. Seems like it would save a lot, and there'd be fewer emissions, you know, on the trip, just to throw in a little greenery there. But Guatemala is our top priority. And she had a special message for Guatemalans.
I want to be clear to folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border. Do not come. Do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border. There are legal methods by which migration can and should occur. But we, as one of our priorities, will discourage illegal migration. And I believe if you come to our border, you will be turned back.
Now, I like how she's hesitant there. I believe if you come to our border, you'll be turned back. I'm not really clear on our policy. Now, you can't blame the vice president for that. I know we want to and make fun of it, but I think that she has a point, because remember, the president, before he became president, in the Democrat debate, said something entirely different.
I would, in fact, make sure that we immediately surge to the border. All those people are seeking asylum. They deserve to be heard. That's who we are. We're a nation that says if you want to flee and you're fleeing oppression, you should come.
All right. So Kamala Harris goes there and says, you know, like, we've been getting some bad press. A little hard for us to hold this down. I just want you to know, do not come. We have laws here, and we really care about how those laws are there. So, you know, don't come here. Not allowed, despite the fact that the president, when he was running, said, you know, come on over, have a great time. And by the way, while Guatemala is our top priority, she has not actually been to the border between the United States and Mexico where people are actually showing up, which is also strange. And I'm just curious, is the mainstream media going to treat Kamala Harris as a arm of the Trump administration now that she's voiced? I mean, this sounds like... Does this not sound like something that Donald Trump could have said? I mean, isn't this, if you just did not know who this was, doesn't this sound like the Trump administration?
I want to be clear to folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border. Do not come. Do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border. There are legal methods by which migration can and should occur.
It just sounds like, if you just drop this, what are you laughing about? Me playing the whole thing again? I just feel like it's Mike Pence. I mean, if you just pictured Mike Pence as a woman, this is what we could have heard. And yet, you know, there won't be the same level of scrutiny, the same coverage. And next awesome audio is, of course, Bill Maher taking on the college scam. And since we just heard about the Yale lecturer, Dr. Killanini, describing how she had fantasies about killing white people and had problems with the white mind that had been structurally impaired somehow because of historic racism, it gives you a sense of why and how correct Bill Maher is for taking on colleges and how absurd it's become.
A wannabe librarian needs a master's degree just to get an entry-level job filing books. You know, I've heard this from so many nurses and teachers and administrators rolling their eyes when relating how they needed to take some course in order to advance in their field. And really, they already learned what they need by working the job. But in the grift that is our higher education, when you want to move up, hold on there, not so fast, toll booth ahead. You need to pay for more education before we decide if you can do what you do.
And you're going to pay a lot because it's been escalating in costs like just through the roof, spreading like wildfire.
And because it's so necessary, colleges can charge whatever they want. Since 1985, the average cost of college has risen 500%. What other business? It doubles every 9 years. Every year it increases at four times the rate of inflation. And yet no one knows how to change a tire. The answer isn't to make college free. The answer is to make it more unnecessary, which it is for most jobs.
And Marr also went on to criticize the ridiculous, you know, classes that are being taken, like how to feel like a victim 101, or, you know, how to identify racism, or the history of sports via Twitter. You know, ridiculous college classes. And he pointed out that people are just admitting to it. You know, like, hey, you know what? I'm there. I don't want to give up my chance to party and that experience. And there's a request for U.S. taxpayers subsidize that. That's just wrong. We need to change how that operates. And I think Marr's onto something there. David Bowe's in for Dory Monson on 97.3 Cairo FM.
I've worked with better, but not many. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.